Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Tony Barnett from LSE AIDS and Destin, and this is the first in this year's series of public lectures, which is funded and generously financed by the Department for International Development, to whom we are enormously grateful. You should look on the LSE AIDS website at frequent intervals to see announcements of upcoming lectures in the series. We tend to grab people as they come through London and get them to speak. So we do things sometimes at short notice. Tonight's speaker is Laurie Garrett. Laurie Garrett is an extraordinary person. There you are, Laurie. I'll call you an extraordinary person. She's a biochemist and an immunologist. She is most distinguished as a journalist and a writer of doorstep books of enormous interest. She is a Pulitzer Prize winner, she's a Polk Prize winner, she's a Peabody Prize winner, and she is currently based at the US Council for Foreign Relations. She contributes to Newsweek and to most of the US media, and also to the media over this side of the Atlantic. Her two incredibly interesting and important books are, first of all, The Coming Plague, in which it's about this thick, in which she discusses and describes the possibilities for the emergence of infectious diseases and the implications of infectious diseases globally. And she followed that up with another huge book called Betrayal of Trust, in which she most pointedly describes the way in which the trust of the human population has been betrayed by the destruction of global public health potential. She also has the distinction of having, on one occasion, on a CNN broadcast in China, having said that the Chinese people did not have a health service, at which point she blacked out the entire Chinese television system as the censors swung in. She does everything on a very large scale, I can tell you. She has the most impressive website of anybody I've ever encountered, and I recommend that you take a look at that. And she also has a PowerPoint presentation which weighs in at 74 megabytes. Laurie, we're looking forward very much to what you have to say tonight. Laurie Garrett.
Thank you, Tony. And let's just go straight to the first, just the setup slide. This is so you know what the books look like and you can go to the store and buy them. This is the blatant advertising segment. It'll be very short, but being an American, you know, we're rather uncouth about these things, as I think you believe we are about absolutely everything. I want to thank Tony very much for the invitation to speak here. You know, the first thing I said to him on the phone is, isn't that where Mick Jagger went? See, I'm dating myself. Probably a whole lot of you in the crowd are like, Mick Jagger. At any rate, but I do have a massive PowerPoint. Want to cover a great deal of information and try not to get too far over the time. So I'm just going to plow straight ahead into it. Because what we've been dealing with, not just in the United States, but now all over the world, in the post-Cold War era, is trying to understand exactly what we mean by national security. What is a nation in the age of cyberspace? And what is the security of a nation? We knew after 9/11 that we needed some fresh thinking, that we needed to take some new perspectives on what security of a nation meant, and that we needed to think in new and bold ways. But we didn't know exactly what security might be. By the way, I'll just point out, this is a pointer, is it not? Apparently not. I live directly under the densest, largest part of that plume. This, of course, is a satellite shot of New York City on 9/11. And some of us inhaled a hefty amount of what happened there. Interestingly, beyond the obvious horrors of what happened that day, there was a strange public health event that occurred. Two molecules were emitted from this plume and inhaled by those of us who live downwind that had never previously been seen in the air on planet Earth. We have no idea what they'll do to us. However, mouse studies show them to be rather strong carcinogens. So we could see some outcomes long, long down the road. We now have a massive cohort study underway enrolling some 200,000 New Yorkers for long-term study to determine if we do have unusual health outcomes. But all that aside, it's important to remember that there already was new thinking about national security in the United States before 9/11. And it was the neoconservative perspective espoused by a host of people, Paul Wolfowitz, the new director of the World Bank, being one of them. And it's important to also note that it wasn't true that we went into Iraq because of 9/11. In fact, at the very first national security briefing, the number one issue on the agenda was, how do we militarily contain the Saddam Hussein regime of Iraq? So our president in the United States had already reached a decision to develop what became known as the Bush Doctrine, that is, the notion of preemptive warfare. Even in the absence of ample evidence, you attack because they might make a problem down the road. That's a rather crude summary of the neoconservative perspective. But, you know, we thought, what if it was real, meaning bioterrorism? What if something got out of the Soviet bioterrorism system? What if smallpox were visited upon us? And then all of a sudden we had the anthrax letters seeming to just validate all that concern. So, all right, if you're willing to accept that we do need some broader and newer thinking about what exactly national security is, and if you think that needs to broaden beyond bombs and bullets to include such things as the threat of anthrax or smallpox, you still have to understand and define what are the boundaries of your thinking if you include transnational threats. Al-Qaeda is what we would call a transnational threat, though this Bush administration tried to tell the American people that Al-Qaeda was somehow linked to the nation of Iraq. The truth is, Al-Qaeda, if linked to any nation, was to Saudi Arabia, which was not our enemy, and is generally would best be referred to as a transnational threat linked to no specific nations at all. So if we are willing to accept a terrorist threat as part of national security, then are we limiting ourselves to those transnational threats that directly involve violence? Is national security dependent on the violence paradigm? Or are there aspects of national security that do not in any way involve a direct threat of violence, even indirect? There are those who are trying to make such issues as global warming or resource scarcity fit into a national security paradigm through a whole series of very convoluted discussions of how if you have a certain amount of global warming and there's people starving over here, they might become terrorists. And then you get a violence paradigm. But are you not walking yourself right into a trap where you will be dismissed by beginning with the assumption that national security is defined as violent threat to the state? Well, here in London, of course, you had your experience with a transnational threat. You've had your 9/11 on 7/7. I don't know what we're going to do with these numbers. And certainly there's new thinking going on in your government trying to understand its vision of transnational threats and what you do about them and which ones you count on the list and which you don't. And this isn't just, you know, intellectual exercising. It gets right to the rock bottom of who sits at the table in the cabinet meeting, who gets to talk to the prime minister, who actually helps shape the nature of your foreign policy. These are defined by how your state understands its security and the threats to its security. So there are big issues at stake in this. These are not trivial intellectual exercises. Many of us have been deeply involved in trying to understand how to define security, and we keep finding ourselves going back to the Grandmaster George Kennan, who way back in 1949 was thinking these same issues through as Winston Churchill was warning the world about the Iron Curtain and the rise of the communist threat. Kennan is famous for creating the guiding principles of national security for the Western world of containment, meaning the containment of the Soviet Union. Well, that is no longer an essential component. Obviously, that battle's been won. But there were other components to Kennan's initial security definitions that deserve and merit revisiting. that security is the continued ability of this, meaning the United States, but it could apply readily here, country to pursue its internal life without serious interference. There are no words in there that say interference from violence, interference from an army, interference from missiles, interference from bombs. So it comes down to defining serious interference and internal life. We work with an operational, and when I say we, my modest, very small global health program at the Council on Foreign Relations, which, by the way, for those of you not familiar with it, is not in any way associated with the United States government. It is an entirely independent, nonpartisan organization based in New York City. So our operational definition is that national security policy operates to secure primary public goods that are at the heart of the social contract between the people and its government. Economic prosperity, governance continuity, ideological sustainability, military capability, population well-being, and territorial integrity. This is, I think, a completely fair and basic way of looking at what is the security of the state. With that in mind, let's start by talking about the tsunami. This has been quite a year we've had. It started with this horrible disaster in Asia, culminating in it being solved by whom? Well, the first responders, the most immediate responders, particularly to Aceh, were military forces. And this was immediately perceived as a security issue. When you look at Aceh and what happened to it, you could see why the only people who could get in there were the United States Navy. You could see why the reshaping of that coastline made it impossible for the Indonesian Navy to get in without capsizing their ships. And it's interesting that while no one sat around and said, is this a national concern, security concern for the United States, for Britain, for France, whomever, almost all of the Western nations sent in military forces to assist. Indeed, the largest scale responder was in the United States Army, which was in position in Aceh in 24 hours. We had additional military responders from the UK and throughout the wealthy world. And we saw direct military-to-military formal relations between the PACCOM, or Pacific Command, of the United States military and the Indonesian military. And at one point, the force strength exceeded for several months the force strength of U.S. military and NATO personnel in Afghanistan, where we have a declared war. This is national security? Well, somebody thought so. Well, why was the security of the American people or the security of the British people or the security of the French people dependent on responding to a tsunami thousands of miles away? We look now at our own tsunami, if you will, in New Orleans, which has the Hurricane Katrina revealed all the flaws, the frailties of the American system to the rest of the world and to ourselves, including the racism of how the American people responded or didn't respond to the crisis in New Orleans and those horrible scenes we saw from the New Orleans Convention Center. And it's interesting to contrast response. I mean, our military response was 24 hours to Aceh, the other side of the world. It was 4 days to New Orleans. And President Bush ended up declaring the hurricane catastrophe a question of national security. This from an administration that does not believe in global warming and that has never considered any environmental issue anything but a problem to destroy, to get out of the way, change the laws, shove it aside. Suddenly we find a president not going all the way to saying, yeah, there might be such a thing as global climate change, but certainly saying a natural catastrophe is a issue of national security, call out the military. That's a huge step for neoconservative thinking. So now we consider ourselves at a stage where we're not just talking about globalization of wealth, globalization of business, globalization of manufacturing, globalization of culture, but also globalization of threat. So transnational threat, transnational national security framework also means transnationalized threat analysis. And it's a threat analysis that takes you to a sense of how is the greater mobility of the global population linked to the threat to that global population. As more and more of humanity is on the move, moving with it, are all the things that humanity has nested in places that once were very remote. And when you think about what's happening on Earth right now, we have the most rapid and dramatic urbanization in human history underway, not just in absolute numbers, but in percentages of populations on the move. We are urbanizing. By the middle of this century, we will be a majority urban planet. And that is occurring in your lifetime, from a vast majority being rural to a bare majority by mid-century urban. You know, those of you grown up here have grown up essentially in an urbanized state. You know, that parts, those countryside things are rather well cared for countrysides. You're hardly living in the wilds if you live in the countrysides of Wales. But London was once the only mega city on Earth, and soon followed by New York. And these two mega cities had centuries to grow and reach full mega city status. Even so, it was in fits and starts of massive epidemics that were experienced in both London and New York City. In the early days of the growth of New York City, they commonly had summer epidemics that claimed the lives of more than 2% of the population, usually turning out to be malaria, yellow fever, or cholera. And here, of course, who can forget the Black Death of the 16th century, or the 1600s, I mean, here in London, followed by the Great Fire. What we see now in the world is that the fastest growing urban centers are in fact in countries that lack both the political and financial wherewithal to make those cities grow in safe form. And so you see cities, and you look at these numbers and projections, you see cities in developing countries, 14 of them in Asia, that are exploding in size, but with no infrastructure, no sewer system that's valid for most of the urban environment, no housing of any decency for most of the residents of the city, no safe drinking water, no basic standards of hygiene. These are places such as Surat, India, from whence pneumonic plague emerged, parts of China from whence SARS emerged. We're seeing that all of this is happening at the same time as globalization is bringing a concentration and shift of wealth, so that nine nations now control 71% of the wealth of the planet. My nation controls a third of the wealth of the planet, with only 300 million people sitting in the country. And even within these countries, we're seeing skewing of the wealth so that an ever smaller percentage of the societies controls an ever larger percentage of the social wealth. And what this means is that if you're going to make these massive cities grow safely, if you're going to make the planetary population move into the 21st century safely, there has to be some movement of money, movement of resources, some understanding in those nine wealthiest nations that their future and safety from transnational threats, since that's a theme tonight, but a host of threats, rests with allowing some serious shifting of wealth. Now, I know Bono and Geldorf have talked about some of the scale. I actually think they're grossly understating how massive the wealth redistribution needs to be, and I do not use that word in a Marxist sense. I don't think this is about some kind of egalitarian distribution of wealth. I think this is about common sense, and it's about creating a world that's safer for all of us to live in the 21st century. I mean, when you look at the conditions around these mega cities and the intermediate cities, the ways in which most people are living, you spend time in them, not just in the part where the tourists go, but where the real people live, you begin to understand what I'm talking about when I talk about safety. But then this means that we're not only globalizing risk, we're also globalizing the complexity of threat analysis. We're looking at something where risk and the challenges of meeting those risks will not come from simple solutions like call out the army, even though I have a president who says pandemic flu, call out the army. Hurricane, call out the army. Al-Qaeda, send in the army. We're looking at something much more complex. And it's going to take all the brain power of every one of you in this room times every major university in the world to try and understand appropriate ways for us to safely venture in to the point where you are all my age. I won't tell you what that is. One of our very conservative members of our House of Representatives made this startling statement last month. The greatest foreign policy issue of our times is neither the problem of war and peace between nation states nor the problem of terrorism, but rather it is the very human vulnerability we all share to disease. Emerging diseases are more grave life and death issues than those related to armaments and evil intents of mendacious minds. It's starting to sound like the president's axis of evil, right? Well, we're definitely venturing into new territory here, partly spurred by the response that everyone saw with SARS, which emerged out of this marketplace, which was a place of exotic animals being sold live for human consumption, handled in a completely cavalier manner. I found them stacked in Guangzhou, this is where SARS came from, box after box, unbelievable range of species, some of them endangered species being sold for human consumption, and stacked often with predator next to prey. The ones that took the blame for SARS were actually victims themselves, the poor civets, such as this animal, which were actually infected by what was now believed to be bats as the index species. Also present in these live markets is a wide variety of bird species, including chickens. Now, out of the same region, Guangdong Province in China, that SARS emerged out of, is the birthplace of virtually every influenza virus that ever circulates planet Earth. This is the natural home of flu. Sometime in 1996, maybe even 1995, this new strain of bird flu, H5N1, emerged out of Guangdong Province. It was covered up, as most things were then, by the Chinese Communist Party, and we didn't hear about it until 97 when it struck Hong Kong. And in an atmosphere of great transparency and openness, the Hong Kong authorities responded to it when they noticed a little boy dying of avian flu and the first small outbreak of cases among human beings who acquired flu somehow, they didn't know how, we still don't know how in most cases, from chickens. Hong Kong responded without a moment's hesitation. It was a very immediate campaign. They destroyed virtually all the chickens in Hong Kong. And what they did by doing that was not just spare Hong Kong that particular outbreak, they actually spared humanity, all of us. They bought us time. They bought us time from this virus, which we have largely squandered. What we now know is that H5N1, this particular form of influenza, is the worst flu virus we have seen in at least 50, maybe 100 years, since 1918. Robert Webster is one of the world's greatest influenza virologists, the man who figured out the life cycle of flu and how it comes from aquatic birds that make the China flyway, migratory birds. And he has analyzed this carefully, labels it the worst influenza virus I've ever seen. He recently was speaking in New York City and said that he gave the odds, and I'm not sure if I buy this, but this was his statement, that the odds were perhaps 50-50 that we will witness a great pandemic dwarfing the 1918 pandemic in the next 2 years. Why are we worried? Well, I'll try to hit these key points and do it fairly swiftly so I have time then to move to a little bit of SARS and then on to HIV before closing and taking your questions. Vaccine production is very slow, very hard to do. Though there are new innovations in technology being put to bear on the problem, none of them are likely to bear fruit anytime soon. Worse yet, all the conditions for the emergence of influenza viruses out of this Guangzhou, Guangdong region are worsening, and I'll get more into that. And as a result, we no longer every year make a monovalent vaccine, which is relatively easy to do. We're now up to having to make trivalent vaccines every year, far more complicated. And indeed, even picking the three each year to make the targets for vaccine production proves controversial and very difficult because now so many flu strains go into circulation annually. The whole pace of the emergence of flu has quickened considerably over the last decade. There will be a severe foreign policy fallout if those 9 wealthy nations in the world are able to develop capacities to protect their own populations but do not share them in any way with the rest of the world, so that we sit back like death voyeurs watching the world die and then wonder why they despise and loathe us and never trust us again, and we face a whole new foreign policy paradigm. The death toll, according to all the computer models and analyses that have been done, if this H5N1 manages to mutate to be a rapid human-to-human transmitter with the same level of contagion we typically see with flus, would certainly dwarf all these weapons of mass destruction that we've been so worried about, and would come up onto the scale of a real nuclear exchange. If that's not national security, I don't know what is. All of the potential is increasing with the increasing prosperity in Asia as people get wealthier and consume more chickens. The lack of public health infrastructures in the Asia region, in the APEC and ASEAN states, and in the People's Republic of China is now coming to haunt us. You know, decades of ignoring it as a foreign policy concern is coming to haunt us. And then I hope to have time to visit some lessons from the SARS epidemic. So since 1997, these numbers are actually off. We're now closer to about 500 million chickens that have been culled or have died of H5N1. Quite unusual, this virus is 100% lethal to chickens. 100%. Whereas the culling operations have been slowed in part because farmers are not paid back for their animals on a scale that is fair. And as a result, there's been cover-up. Why, as a farmer, would you tell the government that you've got dying chickens if you know this is what's going to happen to them and nobody's going to pay you for them? So we have to come up with mechanisms for allowing farmers not to pay a price for alerting authorities. So far, the lack of such a mechanism has really slowed down our knowledge of what's going on with the virus. So what is going on with the virus, and where is it? How does it move around the world? We now understand that influenzas are naturally migratory aquatic bird viruses, mostly ducks and geese, carried usually harmlessly by those host animals as a sort of perfect parasite that happily resides inside of its host and does not kill its host. The migratory birds carry their viruses across a vast flyway. The key flyway segment, and I should have used the other mic for just a moment. I can't make the pointer. I'll step away from the mic for one moment here. The key section of the flyway is from southern Indonesia into central China. The migratory birds make their north-south migration every year, and historically, this really wasn't terribly relevant to human beings because flus were a generally rarer event. But what has happened over the last century actually, we can go back further in time, the last 4 or 5 centuries, is that China's population has skyrocketed. China's really been an overpopulated country for a very long time by human beings. And they've done tremendous damage to their natural ecology well before the current industrialization. And that has really sped up the deterioration of the environment. So many of the lakes, streams, rivers, and so on that the migratory birds would have landed on are no longer desirable places for these animals. They've been dammed, they've been polluted, they've been drained, and much of China is actually the most rapidly growing desert in the world at the moment. Just to give you an example, I drove in 2003 from Beijing to southern Shaanxi province and then over to Hubei. For 12 and a half hours, I never saw a plant. So this is desertification. You see giant towers of dust blowing about in the winds. So the migratory birds are forced to land on farms for their sustenance and their water as they make their migration. And there they get into battles with domestic livestock over food and water. And when that happens, they pass their what is to them a harmless passenger, the flu virus, onto the other animals, and it can be a lethal event to the other animals, or it will certainly mutate once it gets into another set of cell types in chickens, in pigs, in horses, and so on. So this is the cycle of flu. This is why every year we have different flu viruses in circulation and we need new vaccines each year. The vaccine from last year's strains rarely gives you much protection against this year's strains. And all of this is accelerating because the deterioration of that ecology is worsening, not only in terms of it being lousier, but larger deterioration range. And then on top of it all, we're getting more and more chicken production. Well, as of a year ago, the range of infected migratory birds was still relatively small. We'd spotted infected animals from about, I'll show you again. But now, the entire southern flyway from southern Indonesia all the way up to central Siberia, Krasnoyarsk, Novosibirsk, has contaminated birds. And the east-west flyway, which is a separate bird population, but they co-mingle in Siberia with the north-south migrating birds, now is infected. And as you all know, it's crossed over to the Black Sea, where birds have contaminated European bird flocks, and we now have infected birds in confirmed in Turkey, disputed as of today in Romania, but very probably also infected in Romania. So it's really just a matter of time before bird populations all over Europe are infected with H5N1. So can it be contained? All right, here comes the question. If you're a policymaker, you're in charge, you're a big shot politician, you're trying to figure out, all right, I'm buying that we got a problem here. I'm buying that this H5N1 is a big deal. Oh, did I leave out one caveat? I think I did. We've never seen H5N1, to our knowledge, in the Homo sapiens species before. So nobody in this room has antibodies against it. I need to make that you thoroughly understand the significance of that. Nobody in this room has natural immunity to H5N1. And the mortality rate in humans that have been infected so far is 55%. And I need to also let you know that even among the 45% survivor population, some of what survival means is truly debilitating. They are not healthy human beings. Some are, but some are not. All right, so if you're the policymaker, you're going to say, well then, yeah, how do you keep that over there? Keep it in that Asian flyway place. Don't let it get here. Don't let it cross the English Channel. No. Make our own new Berlin Wall real quick. So the question is, containment possible? If an outbreak occurs of a mutational event where H5N1 becomes a typical human-to-human rapid contagious transmitter, and by the way, we don't know what that mutation is. We don't know what the virus needs to do, so it's very hard to do prediction. It's very hard to answer the question, how likely is this event to occur? But if this did happen, can containment be done? So key studies published in August and September in Science and Nature try to address these. One is done by Emory University team. They created a mythological model, a Southeast Asian city with 500,000 people. And their assumptions built into the answer that says, yes, it might be possible to contain, are, I think, defeating of the model to begin with. Because they, first of all, assume that less than 1 out of 1,000 people would be able to escape the outbreak region. So you would not have the virus get out of the region. Second, that it would be spotted just like that, which so far, I mean, we have an 8-week lag time in reporting human cases from Vietnam. That the one drug that's showing any real efficacy, as far as we know, and this is actually not in clinical settings, but in animal studies and test tube studies, but the one drug that does seem to show some efficacy, Tamiflu, would be massively distributed to the targeted area within 21 days, everybody medicated, that the key households would be put under strict quarantines. The whole World Health Organization Tamiflu stockpile would somehow get mobilized from Geneva to this site, and that there would be no drug resistance against Tamiflu in the viral population. If all those ifs hold true, then containment might work, they said. And similarly, a multinational study done partly by a team here from the UK used Thailand as their model. They also assumed no Tamiflu resistance. They assumed about 60% infection rate with about half of cases clinically observable. Of course, what's key about flu? Well, a lot of people are invisibly infected, and yet they shed virus. Virus is in them, and it's coming out of them, and to other people, to the doorknob, to surfaces they touch, to cups of water, and so on. And so, in fact, you know, the kind of containment models you might have used against smallpox won't work for flu because you can't spot everybody who's infected. You don't know who the carriers are. But they're assuming that at least half of all the carriers would be symptomatically observable. They still end up concluding that no single nation strategy would work. There'd have to be a whole regional strategy, which, by the way, if you happen to be Thailand thinking about your national security, you've got a big, bad, ugly regional player called Burma that don't cooperate and play nicely in the sandbox. It assumes that you move in with sweeping quarantines, you take many, many different strategic public health approaches, and then the entire effort's got to be well underway within less than 30 days, and then, yes, it might be possible to do. WHO looks at all the available studies. They conclude WHO has a maximum of 30 days to implement a strategy, but notification from countries in Asia so far is running between 8 to 80 days. Romania, it turns out, knew they had dying birds in early September and only just notified at the end of last week. Assuming best-case notification, you got a compliant, goody-goody country. They let you know. They tip off the world. They know it's going to have huge economic repercussions against them, and they still notify. They say it can't be done. Well, we have a lot of disturbing findings. One is that feeding the dead meat of animals that died of H5N1 to tigers in Bangkok killed the tigers, so it's carried in the meat. Similarly, feeding it to felines shows that domestic cats have a 100% death rate. Ferrets fed it had disturbing symptoms not usually seen, such as rear leg paralysis and so on, and again, 100% death rate. We have the first indications of asymptomatic carrier chickens in Indonesia emerging, which is pretty scary. So key disturbing findings on the clinical level, again, 55% death rate. The deaths are mostly in young people, which was the same in 1918. The key age group that died in 1918 was between 15 and 40 years of age. It was not the elderly. You know, we triage all influenza response to senior citizens. That's how we triage our available, because we never have in any year enough vaccine, enough medicine, enough anything for flu. Well, that triage would actually work against us if we had a 1918-style epidemic. This is what we're seeing right now. In fact, a key group of the deaths have been children. Why are these groups dying? If everybody is lacking immunity, it's not a question that the old people somehow have a better immune system. In fact, it may be just the opposite, because it looks like what kills people, what makes people so sick when their body is exposed to H5N1, is that their immune system says, whoa, I've never seen anything like that before. Whatever that is, we got to pull out the entire armamentarium. You know, the sniper guns aren't going to be enough. We're bringing in the nukes. And your lungs get destroyed. It's a battlefield inside your lungs. And what kills people is the collateral damage of this massive immune response. We do have the first proof of some human asymptomatic carriers who were capable of transmitting. And we have seen now three cases, not just two, one, of transmission from patient to healthcare worker. So we know human to human does happen. But it's very rare and it's very difficult. The virus has not yet made that big mutational event. The other disturbing findings, we do have a network of surveillance laboratories, particularly in the target area in Asia. But again, because of the lack of investment in public health in these regions, these laboratories are woefully inadequate, and the lag time between spotting a possible case and doing all the laboratory work to confirm it and then notifying is just absolutely dastardly, horrible. You probably all heard in the news that last week it was announced and published in both Science and Nature that the 1918 virus had been reconstructed from the nucleotides up. And we now have it, and they've run it, samples of said reconstructed virus through laboratory animals. It, too, proves to be 100% like the H5N1, 100% lethal to chickens in lab and rodents. It also appears to have originated as a bird virus and to have jumped directly from birds to humans rather than through an intermediary species. It also, like as we are seeing with H5N1, appears over a long period of time to have made incremental mutational events, eventually poking through to the right one to make it a human-to-human transmitter, rather than, for those biologists in the crowd, a singular recombinational event that suddenly leapt the virus from one sort of species target level to another. It also looks like it caused this acute immune response, and that the young people were dying of this acute overreaction of their immune system, and literally it filled the lungs with fluids, and people drowned in their own fluids. New York City's done their model using a software program called FluSurge to see what would happen if we had a pandemic in New York. I have to say, very few major cities in the world, and I think London would fit in this sorry list, have thorough pandemic preparedness plans. New York is unique in that since we experienced 9/11, and before that West Nile virus, and before that the World Trade Center attack of 1993, and the anthrax letters, we have a public health department that takes threat analysis pretty seriously. They ran a very conservative set of assumptions, an attack rate of only 15% to 25% by the virus, so your total attacked population is somewhere between 1.2 to 2.8 million people. Still, they could have outpatient visits of up to 1.2 million. I don't know what clinic they think everybody's going to go to. And hospitalizations that could reach 280,000 people with 114,000 deaths. Our total hospital capacity, if every other patient is shoved out, all the cancer patients, everybody, and you use every single hospital bed in New York City, is only 28,000. So 1 out of 10 would get hospitalized that needed hospitalization. On top of that, you have to ask, well, the infection rate would also hit the healthcare workers, so who's taking care of everybody? Where are you warehousing all those patients? The morgue capacity is also only at about roughly maximum. We can process about 60 to 70 patients per morgue facility a day. So you quickly hit max on where do you put the bodies and how do you cremate them all. Very few cities have gone through these mental exercises. And again, this is with an assumption that the death rate is less than 1% of those infected. And as I told you, it's currently running at 55%. So if H5N1 hit today, the first thing we would see is that the airlines unions have all made it abundantly clear they will not fly into a so-called contaminated zone. So long before any government might choose to shut an airport, the planes won't be flying. This will affect not only passenger travel, but also our just-in-time delivery system. You know, just about everything that you see on your store shelves now was delivered within the previous, at least on the fancy stores, the so-called efficient operations. Almost all supplies were delivered in the last 48 to 72 hours because inventorying goods costs money. We're now in a globalized economy where things are getting made in China and delivered just in time to be on shelves here in London. And that includes food. I'm sure that every one of you today at lunch ate something that didn't grow in the UK. Maybe the tomato came from Belgium, the lettuce came from Italy, the bread from France, I don't know. But I'm sure that at least one thing that went in your mouth and you swallowed did not come from the UK. How would all that get here? Who's going to take care of transport? You start realizing that you're talking about a lot more than a viral event. You're suddenly talking about a massive global economic event, an event where authorities would have to figure out how to deliver food, how to keep the basic machinery of society operating. Now, this one drug, Tamiflu, unfortunately, all those scenarios said were assuming no resistance. But actually, resistance is emerging towards Tamiflu. It takes 8 times the dose to have the same impact clinically with Tamiflu as was the case in 1997 in Hong Kong when H5N1 first emerged. And it's only made in one factory in Switzerland. And the company, Roche, which holds the patent, you could ask why have we not done compulsory licensing for those of you hip about World Trade Organization. We can get into that later. But it's made in one factory, and what if Switzerland says, we ain't letting this stuff leave. You may have paid for it, but we got a crisis here, and we're saving the Swiss. Well, what do we do? Send in the United States Air Force? We want our Tamiflu? Well, you could also, you're laughing and chuckling, but where is our flu vaccine made? Well, some of it's made on U.S. territory, but some of it's made right here, the factories outside London. And so what happens if the British government says, you know what, we don't want that vaccine leaving Chiron. We'd like it here for the English people, the people of the U.K. Why should we let it go to, well, what, we're going to send in the United States Air Force for a forced landing outside London demanding our vaccine? You start to realize you're getting to some pretty wild foreign policy territory here. Our current stockpile is only enough for 2.3 million people. And every single one of the computer models shows you need enough for half the population in order for Tamiflu to have a public health impact. If today we had to respond, the World Health Organization, our great barrier between the microbes and us, when I wrote my first analysis of this that appeared in Foreign Affairs in June, WHO's total flu team was 5 people, 2 of them clerical. It's now up to a whopping 12 people, 3 of them clerical. So we have 12 people that are the protection between you and me, and they can rev up in a crisis and move people from other parts of WHO to the flu team and ultimately have a whopping 200 people to protect 6 billion plus on planet Earth. The G8 nations have made it clear in their contemplations of these issues that they would concentrate their efforts on their own people, which is logical. But that means we would not be sharing with other nations, and we would have to deal with the global fallout of us having survived and they not. China, the key player, the birthplace of flu, is not a member of the G8, not party to most of these negotiations. So most of the global mechanisms of response would fail. WHO's best case scenario, if they assume a very low case fatality rate of less than 1%, and a pandemic emerges, is that somewhere between 2 and 7.4 million people in the world would die. That if we had optimal vaccine production capacity, which, by the way, is we've never had, but if we did, we might have enough vaccine for 5% of the planet. We might have enough Tamiflu if Roche revved up, built more factories, which they say they're going to do, for 2% of the global population. But we might have up to 1.6 billion people requiring medical attention. From whom? Where? How? If we get a year before the great mutational event occurs, we still have to deal with the fact that the fastest growing GDP is China, that chicken consumption is skyrocketing, that if they stay on this trajectory, they're going to be consuming 10 billion chickens a year in China by the end of this decade. That Asian flyway is continuing to deteriorate, only worsening, not getting better, and that we have a total market failure in vaccine production, which is to say that if you're a classic Adam Smithite and you think supply and demand are linked, you've got to somehow explain how it is that we got 6 billion people that demand vaccine and we have a supply that never once in history has exceeded 260 million. So some of the diplomatic crisis points are that we would have, as I said, this problem of possible nationalization of vaccine and drug supplies, that we'd have this disproportionate survival rate of the wealthy nations with the poor nations and middle-income nations being denied possible benefits. We'd have this whole issue of just-in-time delivery would not only affect all of the issues I described, but also other pharmaceuticals. And we would possibly have a situation in the United States where we'd want to put the army on the Mexican border to keep Mexicans from coming in to try and survive and get drugs and vaccines. And you here could have the possibility that Austria would put the army to keep the Turks out and God knows what else across Europe. So I do think that the flu crisis constitutes, by any definition, but certainly by George Kennan's, a national security threat. And certainly if you look at what happened with SARS in 2003, and I was there throughout, that became a clear national security threat, not just for China, but for the region, and one that was exacerbated by the fact that the people feared, loathed, and knew their government was lying to them, and therefore didn't trust real information and relied on panicked rumors, mostly from SMS text messaging. You had all the kind of responses that said to you, this is including people making their own quarantine barricades. decades and barricading off villages that said, we don't trust our CDC, we don't trust our public health infrastructure, they've lied to us, they've cheated us, they've robbed us. And so the only way China could bring it under control was to literally declare the whole nation infected and set up barricades everywhere across China in which you were demanded, your fever was taken, and if you were found to have a fever of any cause, they didn't have any way to test for SARS. You went off to a military hospital. End of story. And then you had the Communist Party putting the great billboards up that declared, the SARS will surely be conquered by our government and the leadership of the Communist Party of China. Right on. And the virus knew, uh-oh, here comes the Communist Party. Jesus Christ, I'm getting out of here. In truth, you know, internally at the time in China, there was a tremendous party struggle. And the virus, you know, there couldn't have been a better moment for SARS to appear. Because the very same day that the first identified case of what later became SARS emerged in Guangdong province, the Chinese Communist Party leadership decided to hand over the mantle of leadership from Jiang Zemin to Hu Jintao in the first peaceful transition of power in Chinese recent history. But it wasn't like the whole party just said, all right, we all loved Jiang Zemin, now we're going to all love Hu Jintao. But rather, it was a real faction fight. And it was a deep faction fight that continues today. And so the party basically said, we're putting a lid on everything in the country until the official ratifying vote in March of the so-called government, even though it's governed by the party, but the so-called government that runs China. And that would be in March. So no scandal could emerge, no crisis could emerge, cover up everything from November to March. SARS emerged in November. And they kept the lie, cover up, until after the party Congress vote and the official government endorsement of Hu Jintao's transition. And then exactly a month later, they said, oops, God, we lied to you all. Sorry. Yes, we have SARS. And then the whole way of dealing with SARS was that faction fight playing out. So one day it would be things like this, the Communist Party will defeat. And it reminded you of the Maoists, you know, in the Cultural Revolution. And the next day it would be, we desperately need scientific expertise from the outside world to assist us. And the message was so mixed that the people had no idea what to believe. And it contributed to the hysteria across Asia. Well, I want to now just quickly kind of run through some key points about HIV/AIDS, which should have been the shot across the bow, should have been the warning sign, but because of the exceptionalism with which we have viewed HIV, a sexually and drug abuse transmitted disease, we never heeded, as a global community, the message that it was sending us. So the great pandemic of today, regardless of whether flu emerges, the great pandemic is the HIV pandemic, which will shortly have eclipsed even the Black Death in the numbers of people killed in the world. But it's a slow motion epidemic. Well, I need to, this shouldn't have been here, but put it here anyway. It's an epidemic that already has clear national security implications for certain countries. And finally, this week, for the first time, or was it last week, Putin uttered the expression AIDS in Russian. He had never said a word about the epidemic. The fastest growing epidemic with AIDS at the moment is Russia. And he finally said something, and he said, this is a threat to the state. It is a national security threat. Well, it's the first time we've heard that, and these numbers have a lot to do with it. The skyrocketing rate of growth of HIV in Russian military recruits is really disturbing. And frankly, a report to the Duma over the summer revealed that a third of the enlistees this last year failed their entry physicals for the military in Russia for health reasons, with HIV, tuberculosis, and drug abuse being the three key reasons for failure. So that's 17 and 18-year-olds. Also, in a report that we published out of the Council of Foreign Relations 2 months ago, we concluded that using molecular epidemiology to track specific HIV strains, using their sort of genetic fingerprinting, if you will, it can be shown that the majority, if not all, strains circulating in Asia originate in one place, Burma, spread primarily along the opium and heroin trails in and out of Burma. So if you are in the Asian region, you could well argue that the ongoing military junta and the its dependence for its financial well-being on the export of opium and heroin constitutes a national security risk to you in the form of transmission of new and variant strains of HIV/AIDS. But overall, I think the key reason, and Tony, I misspelled your name. I think a key reason that we've had trouble as a global community understanding and appreciating the security dimensions of HIV/AIDS is that it's a slow motion epidemic. You know, it's not like flu would be, where one day all of you are in class as per normal, and 2 weeks later, this room is empty, the university shut down, and everybody's in a state of panic. HIV has crept up among our species, and even as an individual infection, it runs more than a decade's course, and its impact on your family, on your workplace, on your social setting may take years to be apparent. All the while, there are coping mechanisms underway. Society's adapting to this new organism, to the death toll and the grief that it's creating, so that much of its impact may be masked by these coping mechanisms. And furthermore, much of the impact of HIV is in concert with other social issues, other disease issues in the same societies. So, for example, one could well argue that Russia would not be facing this dire situation with HIV today if it hadn't been defeated in the Cold War, if it hadn't undergone that whole sense, as a society does, of being the defeated one in a war, with suicidal behavior, alcoholism, high drug abuse, a shrinking overall demographic, and tremendous economic disruption. So these things go hand in hand, and it's not a neat and tidy picture. If you look at the national infection rates and the trends in HIV prevalence in some countries, it's of course deeply disturbing. But the other thing is, you look at something like Botswana's infection rate or South African estimated infection rate, and the key to understand is these are people who won't be dying, won't have AIDS, much less be deceased, for many years to come. So the real impact on these societies has yet to be felt. In fact, the most important thing to understand about AIDS is that this is still an epidemic in its infancy. This is still a new global pandemic. It hasn't shown that classic bell-shaped curve. We haven't seen the emergence of an immune population. In fact, as far as we know, nobody's immune to HIV/AIDS. The only quote-unquote immunity is people who happen to inherit a specific genetic trait that renders them to have receptors that the virus cannot use to enter cells. We have seen an impact on life expectancy, with the severe downturns in many countries. How much of this is directly HIV, how much is HIV in concert with other factors, it almost doesn't matter. The point is that a massive global investment in sub-Saharan African development is being reversed. And we're back to life expectancy, infant mortality, and child mortality indicators that look back at World War II levels in many societies. This is a little busy as a slide, but one chunk of it in the red and pink is Zimbabwe and the gray and black Malawi. We're looking at pre-AIDS versus AIDS mortalities. And you can see in just about every age group, very, very, very clear differences in mortality rates across the region. We're seeing a steady increase in orphaning. It's important to define what an orphan is when people talk about HIV, because it can be a little confusing. I was actually startled when I started going through the AIDS orphans data and realized that I was an orphan, because in the West, in the wealthy world, we tend to think of an orphan as somebody who has no parents. But the actual definition of orphaning as used by people working in global health is the loss of a parent, usually of mother, as the key indicator of orphaning. So I lost my mother when I was 19. look at a lot of the literature about AIDS orphaning and how that will affect national security, and I say balderdash to much of it. I think that kids can tough through the loss of even their mother and grow up to be very healthy and productive adults. However, when you have a scale of orphaning, that means that kids are growing up just surrounded by not just other orphans, but of that grief, of that collective loss, and of that collective economic depression, you begin to understand that we could have a very significant restructuring of societies. And those of you who are dealing with HIV/AIDS are probably familiar with this kind of demographic table, but those of you who have not seen it, I need to quickly explain what it is, because I think it's the most important indicator of what we're looking at that you can see. This is a demographic distribution of a society, in this case Botswana, but you could do it for the UK, you could do it for any society. And down the center, you see a zero mark, so that to one side is the distribution of females in the society, and the other side is males. And across the bottom is their numbers, and up the side, their age group. So if, for example, you were looking across the top, you're looking at the distribution of over 80-year-old males and females, and at the bottom, you're looking at babies. In the dark black is what the projected distribution of the Botswana society would be if AIDS had never happened. And in the red is what the distribution of society is because of AIDS. What you notice is why it's called the chimney effect, because it destroys that whole productive labor force age. It destroys that parenting age. It eliminates the whole notion of middle age and creates this chimney of adults with this massive, what's called the youth bulge beneath it. Young people without parenting, without nurturing, without mentoring. Very difficult to look at a distribution like that and imagine a viable economy, imaginable a structure that really works with a society that will function properly. You know, some security people look at this and say, ah, that's civil war. Some economists look at that and say, that's total economic collapse. We don't know yet. What we do know is that this is what Europe looked like after the Black Death. Europe, 44% of the European population when the Black Death was gone in the 14th century were under 19 years of age. And you had this tremendous youth bulge effect. Europe was fundamentally restructured by the Black Death in dozens and dozens of ways, most of which, ironically, in the long run, have turned out to be good for Europe. But it was a pretty ugly way to get there. If you ask about the chimney effect as a theoretical premise, I can tell you that it's already a reality, as this 81-year-old woman explained to me in her home in Chebe, Uganda, where surrounded by graves, she'd lost 10 out of 23 of her children to AIDS. She was raising 23 grandchildren, and she knew she was going to die, and those kids were going to end up like these orphans who ultimately get farmed out to other little girls to raise them, who are from the same clan. So we have children raising children. And the real tragedy of this is that what's being lost is a sense of the history, the values, the ancestry, and the culture of your people. And you can see it when you go to certain villages where the epidemic's very, very old, such as this village, Kansansero, located on the Uganda-Tanzania border on Lake Victoria. It seems, all evidence points to this as the place from which the modern AIDS epidemic emerged. They've been suffering large-scale AIDS-related deaths since the mid-1970s, if not early 1970s. And today, almost everybody's an AIDS orphan. The adults are AIDS orphans, the kids are AIDS orphans, and it's a place where people cannot tell you the history of the place, the history of the people, their cultural traditions, who was whose mother, father, what have you, so that you're seeing a cultural collapse, certainly. But also it's a place where most of the girls end up prostitutes, most of the boys end up their customers, and the biggest, baddest kid gets the most food. This is a pretty rough way to view the future of Africa, and I would hope this would not be Africa's future. But Kansansero is a warning sign to all of us, and certainly an indication of security. Many people have asked, well, then let the teachers pick up the slack. But we're seeing a loss in the teaching population, and most countries with high endemic HIV are having trouble replacing the ranks of their teacher loss, similarly of policemen and of soldiers. And let me just quickly zoom through to the end here and just say that I'm not even going to go there. I'm going to end. And just because we're running a little bit over and I want to have time for your questions. I do very strongly believe that HIV/AIDS is a national security issue. It's a national security issue not only for countries with very high endemic rates, but for countries like ours that have very low rates, comparatively low rates, of HIV/AIDS in their populations. It is a security risk for a whole host of reasons that we could elucidate, but let's just look at a few of the key ones. I will say what I don't think is true, which you have heard rhetorically from a lot of politicians. I don't think AIDS is a security risk because somehow it's going to foment terrorism in disrupted societies, or all these AIDS orphans are going to, you know, pick up guns and start civil wars. I don't think it's a national security issue because it's going to, you know, massively destabilize whole regions of key strategic interest. But I do think that it is a national security risk to our society and other wealthy societies in the world, as assuredly as it is for the societies in which the epidemics are unfolding. Because what we are seeing in slow motion from HIV is the same as, very similar to what we would see in rapid motion with pandemic flu. Huge economic disruption. So massive, but we are unable to see it and to parse it out because of the time table over which it's occurring. Huge changes in the sense of future and of hope in the societies themselves. And when one doesn't have a sense of future, if one becomes fatalistic and thinks, you know, I'm grieving and somebody soon will grieve for me, then you don't bother to go to the LSC. You don't bother to try and teach yourself skills that will require years to bear fruit. You don't imagine for yourself, for your children, for your family, for your community, building a future that requires many, many, many years of hard, tedious work where the payoff may come when you're 35 years old. If now your life expectancy statistically is 33, why would you do all the things necessary to build to a future that won't bear fruit till you're 35 or 40? And so what we're really seeing in slow motion is a kind of global security question that asks, what will this next generation look like and the generation after it? How can we create a world in which there's hope that Africa will be a true partner in the world, that the poorest countries of the world will become true partners in the world, if we've erased any sense of hope, any sense of future? So I do have a sense of hope and future, and one of the things I'm hoping for is some very smart questions from all of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Laurie. Those of you who are leaving, please leave quickly.
And thank you for coming.
We have about half an hour for questions. Would you please, if you have a question, like to stand up and someone will come to you with a microphone. And would you please say who you are and then ask your question clearly. So, questions, please.
This always happens.
It always happens.
When I finish my talks, they're all like,
there we are.
Hi, my name's Jen. I was wondering what your thoughts are on whether you think that the approach for tackling HIV/AIDS and influenza is more a responsibility for international institutions, or whether you think the driving force will be more national governments.
I think that, let me take those separately, but you're going to end up in the same place. For HIV/AIDS, it's very clear that the response cannot come just from government. First of all, most of the governments in highly affected countries are very poor, so they lack the resources to respond without external assistance. And if you look back since 1981, when we first knew that this new virus was out there and this new disease existed, most of the wealthy world first responded to the cases in their own countries. And then once they thought, well, we've got this sort of under control, we can kind of, sit back, there was this long period of, well, why is it our responsibility to respond? Why should this be on our plate? And so we really sat back for an awfully long time and watched Africa die. And then we started watching other parts of the world die. And, one could argue that we're still barely lifting a finger. We are finally in the right log scale of donation. So we're talking billions being donated from a vast array of things, not just directly from governments. But I don't think we've hit the right arithmetic yet. And we've still not figured out mechanisms for responding that understand that response isn't just from governments. It's from everybody in this room, and it's from all kinds of organizations and companies and all of that. Well, if you look at what would happen with pandemic flu, the list of things government could rationally do, and I think we'll see a lot of irrational government action, such as massive quarantines and shutting borders and all sorts of crazy things. But the list of things government can rationally do is fairly limited. And there will be a tremendous need for people to respond as local communities, to take care of each other, and to discover what we've long since lost in the Western world, which is a sense of know thy neighbor and love thy neighbor, and be there for them, because there will be such a short list of things government will be able to do.
We have a microphone here, please, in the middle.
Thanks, Laurie.
James, say who you are.
James Putzel from the Development Studies Institute and the Crisis States Research Center here at the school. Thanks very much for that talk, and it's a very moving and also, I think, a very frightening talk, maybe spurring people into action. But it disturbed me a little bit, the kind of flippant ideological undercurrent to some of what you had to say. When we've seen some success in fighting epidemics historically, or even in relationship to HIV/AIDS, it's required some steering from government. One could argue that Senegal or Uganda's progress, such as it is, was in part driven by somewhat authoritarian means. I'd like to hear what you might have thought, or if you've looked at all, about how the Cuban epidemic was dealt with so far. And also in relationship to China and the way you spoke about it, maybe you could look at China comparatively to India, when we look like to like in population size and development level, and assess how they might compare in terms of ability to respond to epidemic disease. Thanks.
Tall order. Certainly the greatest success story in battling HIV/AIDS to date is Thailand. There can be absolutely no doubt about it. I would hold any country up in comparison and say balderdash. Uganda is not the great success story, and certainly a lot of the Uganda story has been greatly exaggerated for, I believe, ideological reasons by my government. And Museveni, knowing where the butter comes from, to butter his bread, has suddenly shifted a lot of his own analysis of what happened in Uganda to conform to the abstinence and faithfulness and marriage model that the United States government is forwarding. The Cuban experience is a complicated one. It started out pretty straightforward, and it was definitely one that made the human rights community very uncomfortable, because the initial intrusion, if you will, of HIV to the island of Cuba was via soldiers who'd fought in Angola for the Cuban army and brought it back from Angola to Cuba. And so the way the government responded was a national testing campaign with mandatory quarantine. And most of the people initially quarantined were those veterans and their sex partners. That was very uncomfortable for the human rights community because the notion of mandatory quarantine for a sexually transmitted disease was considered quite odious. Cuba took a lot of criticism, but it worked. It worked until the Cuban economy reached a point where they needed to open to tourist trade and external trade on a large scale, and there began to be a fairly serious prostitution situation in Cuba. So today they have a much less controllable spread of HIV in Cuba. They have long since abandoned mandatory quarantine. And they have a situation that is probably more comparable to what we see now in Brazil, which is to say that it is seen as a state responsibility to provide free and confidential testing and massive education about the disease and treatment. So that, like Brazil, Cuba is able to approach HIV/AIDS in a humane fashion that is, by all accounts, far more successful than what we're seeing certainly in the United States, where we're seeing a new infection rate that's going up. I don't know that the Cuban model, if it is a model, is transferable. I think it's more interesting to ask fundamentally about the Brazil model. And we can talk about that if you're interested. Your second question, comparing China and India, I actually spent a lot of time doing just that. And on one level, they're very, very difficult to compare because China is a place where all things are dictated from the top, and very little ever politically or institutionally emanates from the bottom up. And it's a society that actually does what it can to squelch the possibility of things emanating from the bottom up. So when it comes from the top, on the one hand, you can have incredible efficiency. I mean, what other country could have had what I showed you with SARS, where every single highway junction in the entire nation for 1.3 billion people had fever checks, right? So if China decides something's a problem, they can mobilize and command, and the entire party structure will be put in play. On the other hand, China has invested virtually nothing in public goods. They don't give a damn about public goods. I've spent a lot of time talking to the Politburo members about this. As far as they're concerned, the only public goods that matter are those that feed the engine of the economy. So highways, yeah, we want highways. Airports, yep, we want fancy airports. But healthcare, forget about it. As many a peasant told me, one night's hospitalization equals a year's income in China for a peasant. And the healthcare system is totally corrupt. It's a payola system from the second you walk in the door. India has a completely different set of problems. Their problem is nothing's from the top. India's chaos. They long since decided that all health is a state responsibility. And so depending on what state you happen to live in, you have a totally variable potential for any kind of a public health infrastructure to address your needs. Not surprisingly, the poorer states have far worse public health apparatuses than the wealthier states, and the states with the higher literacy rates have better public health apparatus than the states with the lower literacy rates, and child mortality, infant mortality, they all track accordingly. How did India respond with pneumonic plague compared to China with SARS? I would say both of them get F grades. Both of them get F grades.
There was one other point that James raised, which I want to push you on, which was the ideological slant of what you had to say.
What was my ideological slant?
James, would you like to clarify?
I wasn't aware I had an ideological slant. I mean, I know I'm kind of slanted against, which is my current administration.
No, and on that, I'm totally sympathetic with you.
I didn't think there'd be a lot of Bush supporters in the room. Right now...
They were the ones who left.
Right. I mean, right now he only has a popularity approval rate of 38% in the United States.
They were all the Bush supporters.
Right.
Anyway, I think you actually addressed my question in relationship to ideology and the contrast between India and China, and in your comments about the top-down approach. in China. But I think it is interesting to look both historically at our own societies and what's going on comparatively in Thailand in particular, where there was really quite a top-down strategy in relationship to the mobilization of the military.
Well, in fact, it was a military junta at the time. And the military junta Thailand was the first country to declare HIV a national security issue. And it was declared a national security issue by a junta.
Professor Prince there.
Gwyn Prince, Alliance Research Professor. Could I ask you to expand on a comment which you made almost towards the end, almost a throwaway comment, when you showed the picture of the old lady in the graveyard? And you pointed out that, of course, the long-term effect of the Black Death had been really rather good. Why should that not be the case with all the ones you've just been describing?
Yeah, well, I could definitely weave a scenario in my mind where I could say that 200 years from now, we would look back on HIV/AIDS in Africa and say, wasn't that a good thing? Look how it changed Africa. But why should we see positive change unfold at the expense of millions of lives and untold suffering? It's a pretty cynical place to go.
Yeah, just a question. My name is Ataru San from the Asia Research Center here at the school. I'm slightly worried.
They're asking you to put the mic towards your mouth.
I'm slightly worried about the public health implications of concentrating on some of the epidemics, because I think there are many diseases which affect the population of the third world but do not attract as much attention. I take example of malaria and also, for example, gastrointestinal diseases. So having spent a lot of time in China, I think Chinese government is very concerned about SARS, but to the neglect of a lot of diseases which are actually far more injurious to the population. So I think concentration on flu and HIV/AIDS, unfortunately, in case of many third world countries, detract attention from what are the top priorities.
I agree completely. In fact, one of the things I think, it was another thing I said as a throwaway, unfortunately, for time reasons, is I actually think that the current focus globally on the big three, HIV, malaria, and TB, and the mechanisms set up that are just sort of solely directed to the big three, with HIV the numero uno, could very well result 10 years from now in a net increase in mortality in the targeted countries due to rising child mortality in particular, because of the redirection of scarce healthcare worker resources. It's more, I don't know to what degree people here understand the situation, but it's a lot less about money than it is about human resources. Lincoln Chen did a study that estimates that the world currently has a deficit of 4 million healthcare workers, and sub-Saharan Africa has a deficit of 1 million. We had a former presidential candidate in the United States, from a billionaire from Texas named Ross Perot. And in his campaigns, he used to get up and say, "Y'all hear that big sucking sound? That's the sound of American jobs going to Mexico." Well, the big sucking sound is nurses coming here from South Africa. The big sucking sound is nurses coming from Asia to the United States. It's this shift at the time of their greatest need. The healthcare workers from India are being brought here. The healthcare workers from Pakistan coming here. So the real crisis is that right now, with all the money that's on the table for HIV, TB, and malaria, if you take, let's say, a program that's supposed to be an outpatient clinic for HIV/AIDS, where they're going to hand out pills, a healthcare worker could very well get offered twice as much to leave the child diarrheal disease program and come over and work very comfortably in this air-conditioned office handing out pills, and get to go to international meetings, meet foreigners, buy goods in Paris at a meeting, 1,001 things that would make it unbelievably attractive to abandon a life's work in child mortality efforts. And we could look back and say that the whole HIV/AIDS campaign ultimately destroyed a lot of the primary care system. That's why I strongly am advocating that we take a radical rethink on the whole implementation of our war against HIV/AIDS.
Justin Parker, London School of Hygiene there.
Thanks for saving me time, Tony.
Yeah, very efficient.
Thanks. Probably got about a million questions. Thank you very much. I certainly it would take a little bit issue with your dismissal of Uganda's success on HIV. I myself have written about how it's been blown out of proportion, but I think there's a lot to learn about the fact that Museveni was the first world leader to talk openly about
Absolutely.
It 2 years before Ronald Reagan. They had a very open and diverse response. They invited many groups to become involved and the like.
But it wasn't abstinence.
No, today it's being used to justify an ABC, right. an absence-only message, and I take issue with that as well. But I don't think we can dismiss everything that happened in Uganda before that and say it wasn't successful. Okay, thank you. My main question, though, now I get to ask a question, is just on the implications of your talk and on the security issue. I mean, the term national security threat or security threat, sorry, should I get shouter? Is this okay? Is used often just to mean it's a big deal. And I think that's how politicians use it. I think that's how Putin was using it. I think that's how Bush referred to the hurricane. It's a really big deal. But we also realize that using the term national security threat has implications and has policy implications. And I'm wondering what you think, in your talk, are the implications of calling avian influenza, HIV, SARS, national security threats. On one hand, it may be a good thing. You know, people, when something's a security threat, it gets a lot of attention, resources, money, rapid turnaround. But you also mentioned the Bush doctrine. If people followed that, then China could invade Burma to stop the spread of HIV. Then the United States could drop bombs on China to stop the spread of avian influenza.
I've even had a couple of senators I will not name in closed-door sessions. Suggest to me that we should exterminate the migratory birds of Asia and that that would stop flu.
So do you think that these health issues should be taken on as security issues by politicians in the political scene? And what do you see as the practical implications of
it? Right. And I think this question is really important, very crucial. It's one that I spend a lot of hours mulling over, and I often rethink and rethink and rethink on this. I think it's very, very important. Let me tell you what the mistake I think a lot of public health advocates make is to leap to the conclusion that we must declare things a national security issue and that will bring money to the table. They're dead wrong. That's not the way it's going to work, nor should that be the reason, the motivator. Money should be at the table for public health because it's right for it to be there. It's right for thousands of empirical reasons and altruistic reasons. And we ought not be, you know, resorting to a security paradigm just in the hope for funds. What does change when a government, particularly, you know, one of the wealthy governments, declares something officially to be a national security paradigm is best illustrated by looking at the difference between what was existent under Clinton and what is existent under Bush in this Pacific area. Clinton, the first president in the United States to broaden the notion of national security to include a transnational issue was George Bush I, who declared that the international cocaine and narcotics trade represented a national security threat to the United States, and that became his rationale for sending United States troops into Colombia. I think that was incorrect. And we could talk about why. Then Clinton came in and, at the urging of the scientific community, ordered what's called a SCISET, which was a special multi-agency executive analysis of emerging diseases. And in 1998, added emerging diseases and HIV to his definition of national security. Now, when the chief executive of the nation says, I'm adding these to the national security, there are a whole set of things that are mandated to happen at that point automatically. Our Central Intelligence Agency set up a whole infectious disease and public health section that had never previously existed. A physician was appointed to the National Security Council. The Department of Defense set up apparatus dedicated to analysis and response capacity. The State Department required that there be an HIV-trained officer in every single embassy in the U.S. system. When Bush came in, Condoleezza Rice, who was very much a traditionalist on these issues, said, ugh, let's get this stuff off the table. National security is nation-state conflict, that's it. And all those sections were eliminated. So a great deal of expertise that had existed in CIA, National Security Council, State Department, DOD, were all eliminated, erased, gone. Then the president decided that to create PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, and declare that he was going to spend $15 billion in 5 years to tackle HIV/AIDS, and he chose to nest it in the State Department, right? Not in HHS, in the State Department. And all of a sudden, the State Department discovered they had no expertise to guide them. They didn't know how to do the job. They didn't know where to turn. They had nobody at CIA anymore. Nobody, because they had destroyed it by changing the definition of national security. These have real significance and real meaning. They are not just rhetoric, and they're not just about money. And I think one of the things Tony and I were talking about earlier, and it gets back to a question over here about how do governments respond in an epidemic or a pandemic, is that if there's anything that needs to be appreciated from what you see right now in Pakistan and Kashmir from the earthquake, what we saw with Hurricane Katrina, what we saw with SARS, what we would likely see with a pandemic flu, is that it's really about, can you create structures of preemption and response? That's government. And does government know how to draw on the private sector resources, the volunteer resources, and coordinate responses that make sense? Right now, government does not.
I have two questions up here and two questions in the middle here. So, lady up there, please. Please say who you are.
Hi. My name is Roseanne Ward, and I used to manage the PR for the UK flu vaccination program in about 5 years in the mid-90s.
You need to speak up a little.
She said
area.
She used to manage public relations for the UK influenza vaccine campaign.
Right.
And what was your rate of successful vaccination?
Yeah, good point. In the early 90s, it was about 3 million dosages.
So most UK said...
It's gone up hugely, up to about, kind of, I think it's late 90s, it was something like 6.5 million, and it's about 9 at the moment. So it's actually quite good in terms of covering the high-risk populations, which is a huge improvement. My kind of questions are more kind of like... more comments really about some of the data that you were, and particularly the mortality figures that you were quoting associated with pandemic influenza, really are. I think that they were somewhat high. As you know, of course, influenza, it doesn't kill that many people directly. What obviously does kill them is that if they have health vulnerabilities that make them more prone to influenza, they're likely to get. If they've got a respiratory condition, they're likely to risk respiratory failure. If they're heart condition, they're more likely to risk a kind of a cardiac event, which
But you're talking about a normal influenza.
I am indeed. But
we're not talking about a normal influenza.
I completely appreciate that. But if you even look at pandemic influenza in 1918 that killed, you know, obviously 30 million people around the world.
50.
Whatever. However, of course, that's...
Well, you're the one challenging my numbers.
No, I appreciate that, but... That was also in the pre-antibiotic era.
Right, but they didn't die of secondary infection. That used to be the dismissed way that the 1918 epidemic was rationalized. We wouldn't have that event
very
revisit
many people did,
because now we have antibiotics.
I understand that, but people did.
Okay.
And I think that if you look at the way that pandemic planning and the WHO's plans, and obviously in the UK we've had plans since the early 90s as well. We're one of the first countries actually who had developed pandemic plans. The reason why we have strategies for targeting certain populations of the community is that, of course, and you're right, that very many young people are infected with influenza because they haven't got any immunity whatsoever. And there is some evidence that some older people can have a developed immunity to certain strains that might be similar to certain types of influenza, that particularly certain strains that might be similar to a new pandemic strain. But the reason why, obviously, we're targeting, vaccines and neuraminidase inhibitors to high-risk populations is because they have underlying high-risk conditions that make them more vulnerable. of course, and I think that rather than coming out with stats that some of those mortality stats, I think it might be more useful to look at the concepts of excess deaths, which we do look at when we look at influenza in the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't generate any of the data. The stats are not mine. They come from the World Health Organization and a host of other studies. And actually, WHO has been attacked for the data, not their estimates, not for highball, but for lowballing it. I've been to many meetings where influenza experts are talking about the hundreds of millions dying. This is because we're not talking about normal flu paradigm. We're not talking about weakened immune systems, underlying illness. In fact, I'll tell you a study that I've been asking, God knows, everywhere, NIH and all over the place, I've been asking, would somebody please do this study in vitro or in mice or some animal model and give us an answer, and nobody's done it. I don't know, maybe Robin, maybe you know if anybody's done this, but Robin Weiss, one of the world's greatest HIV researchers, happens to be gracing us with his presence. It is that we don't know what the HIV populations, what would happen when H5N1 hits them. And here's the curious thing. Your first thought would be, oh my God, if H5N1 turns into a human-to-human transmitter, Africa is toast. Very much what you're saying. If you have this underlying condition, then, oh my God, Africa would be like kindling on a forest fire. But what I observed with SARS in Guangzhou was very interesting. Where did the Chinese authorities put the first, wasn't then called SARS, but the first SARS patients? On the AIDS ward. Why? Because they didn't give a damn about the people with AIDS. And they just assumed that, you know, probably the AIDS patients would die. To this day, there's not been one verified HIV-positive person with SARS. And on that ward, the healthcare workers that went between the SARS patients and the HIV patients, most of them got SARS. Several of them died of it. And yet, none of the AIDS patients got SARS. Why? Because SARS also, like H5N1, was so foreign to the human immune system that what you were seeing when people got SARS was this cytokine storm, this tremendous over-response of their immune systems, which the HIV patients weren't capable of mustering. So the irony is we could be in a situation where, in fact, Africa would be the firebreak. You know? Now, there's got to be a way to test that and so that we can factor that into our global models and our, you know, global sense of priorities. But what I'm trying to say to you is, everything you're saying for a normal flu year is absolutely true, and I'm glad you're saying it, and everybody in this room should know it and understand it, and that has been the fundamental underpinnings of our public health approach, not just here in the UK, but all over the world, to dealing with influenza. But H5N1 is not a normal influenza, and what would happen with H5N1, based on what we've seen so far in the clinical cases, is that precisely the healthiest people would have the greatest mortality.
Were you going to come back with a small supplementary?
Sure. No, I think that, you know, of course, immune-compromised patients, they are a target high-risk group for vaccination and neuraminidase inhibitors. And, of course, and you're absolutely right to say that HIV and AIDS patients, particularly, of course, are one of the very vulnerable communities of our people in our globally when a pandemic flu hits.
Gentlemen there at the back, please. Then we have two more in the middle here. And then we're moving rapidly towards the end of our question session. So if you have questions to ask, this will be right. Okay. I thought that would elicit a few hands if I said that.
Hi. My name's Graham Martin. There's a few assumptions that you made about the immune system during your talk. And one of the big assumptions which I need to stress, especially because there's a lot of young people here in the audience, is do vaccinations actually work? And secondly, do they not do a considerable amount of harm to the immune system?
Okay. Are you speaking of all vaccines generally because you oppose vaccination as a rule? Or are you speaking specifically of influenza or pandemic flu?
If you want to look at an immune system, basically what's actually making people more vulnerable to various different mutating strains is firstly they have mutation that's going on within themselves put there by live viruses, and second to that you also have a weakened, suppressed immune system where you have children who can't even have childhood diseases now, which actually boosts their immune system.
Okay, well, I respectfully disagree with everything you just said, but I'm very well aware that there's a strong anti-vaccination movement here in the UK.
Can we move the microphone down here, please? There is somebody at the front. We have a gentleman at the front here, and then we'll take questions from the middle. Could you say who you are, please, and you'll need to speak up.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Is it on?
Is it? Oh.
I think you're going to have to stand up and project your voice.
So could everybody see, hear the basics there? All right. Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, right now, I went and looked at some of the avian flu cases that had occurred in Vietnam. And, of course, we're all very nervously watching the situation in Jakarta because Indonesia, you know, takes us out of the what if it comes out of a village into what if it comes out of one of the mega cities with an international airport. And we now have 6 deaths confirmed due to H5N1 in Jakarta and roughly 100 suspected infections. So the Jakarta situation is very troubling. And certainly, culturally, what you would do about trying to tackle influenza control programs in Indonesia would be different from what you might do in rural Vietnam or in Cambodia or, for that matter, in urban China. You have to assume that it's the local responders who are in charge, and they're operating based on local cultural taboos and understandings. I would certainly hope so, or it won't be successful. The most obvious things that come to mind right now is that one of the hallmarks of Asian cultures, with the exception of the vegetarian cultures of parts of Tibet and India, is the chicken. You do have cultures that also put a high priority on pig, pork meat, but chicken meat is pretty damn ubiquitous across Asia and very important for a number of key holidays and so on. Chicken farming is also a prestige enterprise. In other words, a lot of the status of a family in many cultures is gauged by how many chickens you're able to constantly keep in your flock. Anything that challenges that is going to be very difficult to change. Let's start with the most obvious public health step. If you could wave a magic wand, put all culture aside, what would be the first thing you'd like to change in Asia right now? That would be open market sales of live chickens. You'd like to see Asia move towards centralized harvesting, slaughterhouse operations with the sale of chicken meat, as we have here. But culturally, that's impossible. Absolutely impossible at this moment. Even in Hong Kong, where there's tremendous public support for taking rational measures and there's a greater understanding of germ theory of disease and a large educated population, even there, there's great opposition to completely eliminating live animal market sale. And any of you that have spent a lot of time in Asia know that you can go through Asian towns and cities and walk down narrow alleyways that are just literally packed with caged live animals. It's one of the reasons we're having a hard time doing the epidemiology of
of the flu, to understand how people are getting H5N1 is because there's so many routes of potential exposure. Just walking through certain alleyways in Hanoi, you'll be exposed to live chickens, whether or not you personally possess any. Certainly, we've already had to make certain cultural choices that are not the ideal. You know, the world is not run by, thankfully, the Communist Party of China, or for that matter, by the government of Cuba, in the sense that you cannot issue a fiat and overnight, you know, say it's okay to take this very radical step. It's not, it would not be supportable in Asia.
We have one or two questions in the middle here, please, and one up there, and then we're going to finish. So
we get, he gets a repeat when you got all,
well,
this
he gets a repeat. We have a repeat up here. He's allowed to have a repeat.
Well, it's a repeat because, I'm sorry, it's not a question, it's a corrective.
Okay.
To return to the answer you gave to Justin Parkhurst, the description that you gave of resources and their availability in the United States is so far from the actuality for those of us who deal with it that it was a travesty. And I would just really wish
which,
to make
which
that
I'm not sure what you're referring to. I'm confused. Which,
well, I wasn't at all confused about what you said. You spoke about a sudden leaching away of capacity to deal with the issue with regard to the intelligence services, for example, which simply isn't the case, just a matter of record.
It's not the case that we have capacity to respond in the intelligence apparatus? Or it is the case?
It is not the case that the capacity which you suggested lacks is lacking.
Well, now it's not.
Julia Ferrari, London School of Hygiene and the Image Project in South Africa.
Yes, my question relates to the anthropological question that was just addressed to you. And in a way, it seems to me that the sort of structural interventions that exist for HIV and AIDS, by their very nature, tackle issues around the institutions that upon which societies are built, in a way, and around which societies revolve. And by their very nature, it seems to me that these changes are very long-term changes that, in a way, are sort of well-suited to dealing with the HIV epidemics because of the nature of the epidemics that you illustrated beforehand. And typically, these are classified as ex-ante interventions. As preventive interventions. In the case of an influenza virus, as the one you described, it seems to me that, and precisely because of what you just said, it seems to me that an approach like this would be very impracticable. And I was wondering whether you think that in this case, then, one would need to think of, instead of an ex post approach, in terms of a structural approach to the epidemic, and whether it does make any sense of to speak of anything like this, really.
Okay, I'm not sure I completely understand your question because,
Julia, I think you're going to have to rephrase it. But just slightly.
If you're talking about structural change in a society, in response to and preemptively for epidemics, certainly for HIV. Because the timetable of any individual infection and overall societal increase in HIV is so protracted, you have time to envision essential changes and, if there's political will, make them. In the case of a more acute pandemic, you obviously don't have that time, which is why preparedness is everything. So that the problem is that you have to have the capacity to imagine as a government, the capacity to imagine as a senator, as a member of parliament, various levels of scenarios, and think what would constitute preparedness against this, that, and the other scenario. And that's a very difficult thing for political leaders to do, not because they're stupid, but because their timetable is so filled with things that have to get done this second, or things that can be concretely explained to the taxpayers that, you know, it was necessary to divert these resources and personnel to this problem right now, even though it might not ever happen, or it might happen in 20 years when I'm long since out of office, or it might happen tomorrow, and I can't tell you which. So, for example, when you look at Hurricane Katrina and New Orleans, now we're all hearing about the hundreds of reports that said those levees would break. The hundreds of reports that said if there was a hurricane category whatever, New Orleans would get wiped out. And all the, well, why didn't government do anything? Why didn't everybody, they had the data, the scientists told them, and they didn't do what they needed to do. Well, it's all about that event horizon problem for political leadership. And if you are in a budgetary tight year, and what year isn't a budgetary tight year from a politician's point of view, then you have to rationalize, why did we put $1 billion into the levees of New Orleans when Iowa corn farmers aren't getting what they think they deserve for their corn? And so I think that bottom line is, with something like HIV, the sort of struggle, if you will, for the medical population, the public health population, and the patient population is about, you know, constantly knocking on the door of power and saying, pay attention to us, we need some changes, this is going to keep going, this structure needs to change, that structure, the health system is incompetent, it needs to be rebuilt this way, etc. But in the case of something like the potential pandemic flu, it's knock at the door and say, wait, just stop what you're doing for this moment, please. Focus on just this and think about what this might mean to your constituency if it happens tomorrow.
Laurie Garrett, thank you very much indeed for coming.
Thank you all.
Thank you for coming. It's great.
I think women are going to have a healthy argument.
I think they're going to have a healthy argument.